First of all, I wanted to thank Tito and Burkhard for the invitation to come to Zurich, which I love to do. In order to frame this consideration that you're thinking about, the ambiguous, often ambiguous relationship between art and design, what I want to do is try to sketch the future of that relationship moving forward, what it might look like in the near future as we consider it. Right now, design enjoys enormous public confidence. Enormous potential is seen for design by the general public, and you can see that in Stockholm if you go to the Pressbyrån, the magazine shop at the Central Station. I counted 33 magazines on design. Those aren't just being read by us, they're being read by people, just the general populace who's interested in how effective design may be on real world problems in real time. Design's probably never seen such general support for its potential going forward. One of the things that we do, the research group I run in Stockholm is called the Experience Design Group. One of the things that we use very frequently is future forecasting as a methodology for looking into the future. We use very, very analytical approaches, not seat-of-the-pants kind of approaches. And that part of the work that we do is led by a guy by the name of Peter Mannen. We look very closely at the future of design, both in terms of near-term future, say 5 to 7 years out, 10, 20 years out, and also we look beyond our lifetime, 50 and 60 years out. And it, let's say that we just look at near-term, future for design. One of the things you can do, if you have a grasp of that, you can decide how you may want to encourage that future or change that future in one way or another. And the things that I want to talk to you about today, which really have to do with sociology and economics and politics, very little about art and design, actually. When we look at those factors and their influence on design and the direction, the trajectory design has right now, given all of its great potential, when we begin to look 5 to 7 years out, here's what we find. That design has actually failed to live up to its promise. That the pendulum is swinging back, decimating design's credibility. Because of this, designers are no longer allowed near issues of consequence. That design is given away free by corporations in India and China because, of course, the profit margin is not in design, the profit margin is in production. This is not so much a prediction, it's already happening in India and China. The design is simply given away as a kind of gratis, complimentary affair. Right now in China, if you want to build a mobile phone, you ask for a prototype, you'll get 20, 25 for free. If you do the same thing in Stockholm, you get one and it's very expensive. Kids with talent acquire design education but only maintain it as a hobby because there's no real future in it. And the Zurich Hochschule für Kunst shuts down its industrial design department to open up a center for artificial intelligence forecasting. This is also not so much of a prediction. If you look at Carnegie Mellon, they've shut down their industrial design program to start an artificial intelligence and robotics program, and we see that as clearly the future moving forward. So one question you could ask is this the scenario we want? And if it's not, how might we change it? So how could, and I want to just start with education, how could education, we'll talk about a variety of things, but how could education reverse this scenario? To conceive of an answer, we might begin by saying that the mission of education is creating new knowledge to distribute for the sake of enlightenment and just the hope of doing good. And no one, not even the most totalitarian of regimes, would argue against the virtues of creating and dispersing knowledge. If you look on the left, you see what you get in Beijing when you Google Tiananmen Square. If you look on the right, you see what you get in Stockholm when you Google Tiananmen Square. So the argues, the quarrels never begin over the virtues of creating and distributing knowledge, the arguments always begin over what knowledge to supply and who to create it. And of course, who creates knowledge immediately predetermines what knowledge is going to be created. So in fact, we would want our students not to ask what knowledge are we going to create, but who's creating it. And as soon as you have the answer to who's creating the knowledge, you pretty much know what knowledge is going to be created. Who decides predetermines the knowledge, and this is an elemental equation in knowledge production. And perhaps the defining argument where the future of design and the future of design education is concerned. Who will decide the future of knowledge production is dependent on a number of variables, but there are certain certainties that we can already count on, and I have come to believe that they will prompt substantial adjustments to the core values at many university art, design, and architecture programs, and in turn, changes in core values in terms of the way in which we understand and embrace design going forward. One of those shifts in core values will certainly be towards interdisciplinarity as a primary research methodology. Everybody talks about interdisciplinarity. I'm a professor of interdisciplinarity. We're actually just seeing the results of how effective it is, and it's not very effective. You fail most of the time. But we're going to get better at it, and people seem to be moving in that direction. And the interdisciplinary science building at Columbia University is the future. I would also recommend Mark Taylor's essay in the New York Times titled "The End of the University as We Know It." Mark is the head of the religion department at Columbia, and you see a place like Columbia embracing this. Clearly. At the Interdisciplinary Science Building, there is no longer a biology department and a physics department and an astroscience department. They work based on themes, not disciplines. If you're studying dark holes, you may not just need astronomers, but physicists and a variety of other different disciplines to bring together in terms of theme-based education. And that is certainly the approach that we take at the Experience Design Group. So, one clear direction for design moving forward will be interdisciplinary focus, not on disciplines, but on themes that require cross-discipline teams to work together. Now, of course, we live in a world noticeably distinct from just a decade ago, perhaps for the creative disciplines, and I want to frame the economic forecast future for design and the creative disciplines in general. Perhaps for the creative disciplines, the difference of greatest consequence is that we now live in the creative economy that Harvard Business School's Gilmore and Pine predicted about 10 years ago, 1998, in a Watershed article entitled "Welcome to the Experience Economy." In that article, Gilmore and Pine predicted a fundamental shift from an economy based on the production of goods and services to an economy producing experiences. And those experiences could be everything from what you're doing today, listening to me, to education, to entertainment. The central thesis of their argument is best explained by the birthday cake. It used to be that people made birthday cakes from scratch. It's a vestige of the agrarian economy. People would go out and buy the eggs from one person, the chocolate from another person, the sugar over here, the milk over there, bring it all home, mix it together, and make your birthday cake. And within a few years after the Second World War, we began to see the emergence of a good-based economy, and we would pay a few francs for a box mix a cake. And later, as the service economy took over, we began to recognize how busy we were, two events that coincided nearly at the same time, and parents began ordering cakes from the bakery within this service economy. I like this picture of the bakery because it looks like the bakery from Mars. I don't know that I would want a cake from this particular bakery. And we were willing to pay 10 or 15 times the amount from a box mix in order to buy it from the bakery. But now, in our time-starved society, parents neither make the cake nor throw the party. Instead, they outsource the entire event to McDonald's or some other business that stages a memorable event for the kids. And the cake is for free. Welcome to the experience economy. The central economic achievement of the 20th century was the greatest increase of material wealth humankind has ever witnessed. But today, in a world defined by rapid change and globalization, creativity is the driving force of this new economy. The growth of the creative economy, expertly narrated by Richard Florida, Daniel Pink, Robert Hayes, is nothing I need recount for you this morning, but it is the most defining characteristic and is having the greatest impact on the production of design and art and education in the creative disciplines above all else that we can detect on the horizon right now. So suffice it to say that advanced economies have become so highly efficient at the production of physical commodities, everything from cakes to automobiles, that significant sectors of the workforce have been freed to create and distribute intangible commodities from software to entertainment to education, making the creative economy a sweet spot for design, art, and education. Broadly speaking, education is yet to approach its would-be potential, which H.G. Wells envisioned in the 1930s. In the 1930s, H.G. Wells said, "We want a Henry Ford today to modernize the distribution of knowledge, make good knowledge cheap and easy in this still very ignorant, ill-educated, ill-served English-speaking world of ours." Wells disparaged the university as a medieval institution whose time had passed, and called for the creation of what he described, these are his words, as a decentralized world brain. This is his pamphlet titled World Brain. And the world brain would collectively collaborate in producing and distributing knowledge. He described it as a depot where knowledge and ideas are received, sorted, summarized, digested, clarified, compared, and distributed. This would be an example of an experience economy. The world brain, Wells imagined, would exploit the future of unending technological advances, such as microfilm, which was a leading edge technology for him. This is microfilm. NASA wanted to take a Bible to the moon, but it was too heavy, so they just turned it into a postage size stamp. Microfilm and left it on the moon. This is a blow up of that. But using leading edge technologies like microfilm, which was, as I said, one of the most advanced technologies for communication in his day, Wells foresaw it, saying any student in any part of the world will be able to sit with his projector in his or her own study at his or her convenience to examine any book, any document, any work of art in an exact replica. Wells imagined a paradigm shift in knowledge production, which we are only just beginning to experience now. And that shift will have long-term effects, and surely we have witnessed some of what he envisioned. His preference for collective collaboration, a kind of interdisciplinarity, his preference for collective collaboration was less a matter of ruling out experts than ruling in grassroots knowledge on a planetary scale. Those are his words, grassroots knowledge on a planetary scale. And so Wells is really talking about this. And here we have the best example of Wikipedia that I know of is the earthen dams expert in New Brunswick, New Jersey. The earthen dams expert in New Brunswick, New Jersey, who has a wiki page on earthen dams in Iraq. I think the United States is on its third invasion of Iraq, at least in my lifetime, and when they invaded for the third time, they had troubles with earthen dams, blowing them up on the first try. And so they didn't have any information on earthen dams in Iraq, so they went to Wiki, they found this guy. He does something else for a living, but he spends every weekend developing his wiki page. He is a grassroots expert on a particular subject. So for Wells, Wikipedia would have been the living in, giving voice to a rising underclass of experts therein turning the question, what knowledge will be supplied and who will create it, into an expression of faith and expertise. The Interactive Encyclopedia surpassed 1 million articles last March with hundreds of thousands of contributors. It has become what I like to describe a supermarket of knowledge. Wikipedia is a supermarket of knowledge. What's troublesome to me about it is that it has a larger than usual homemade section. Whether or not that homemade section is trustworthy or not, we don't know. Current research tells us fundamental changes with long-term effects, like this one, are afoot in the creative disciplines today, in part the result of the emergence of the creative economy, or the experience economy, which, in due course, will require substantial adjustments to all of your core values. The program that I run in Stockholm is called the, as I said, the Experience Design Group, and the very existence of an MFA program in experience design could be interpreted as corroborating evidence of what many believe. The creative disciplines are undergoing the most significant paradigm shift in living memory as professions migrate from conventional design tasks, design me a toaster, to design me a system. Or in other words, towards conceiving of the intangible commodities which feed the creative economy. Now, here we see design just arriving at this moment, and if we look back on this with a certain amount of historical reflection, we recognize that the art world arrived here quite a long time ago, around 1968, with an article in Art Forum by Jack Burnham called Systems Aesthetics, and then he followed that up later with Real-Time Systems, in a book all written in 1968, in which he credited artists like Hans Hacke, Joseph Asuth, Larry Alloway, with designing systems, not making works of art. But it's largely exactly the same kind of approach that design is beginning to take today. Let me move back over to design to talk to you about this Hacke piece I'm sure you all know, in which the Rhine was declared polluted and unsalvageable, and he made clear by building this system for cleaning polluted water that it could be cleaned up, and ultimately, as we know, it was. But let me move back over to design. There are few design students I know who don't just get off on the iPod, the design of this little object, the iPod. But of course, the iPod is actually a minor character in a much larger system. And I say this because I know the people who were sitting around the table at Apple when this idea was hatched. There was never a talk about an iPod. There was never a talk about a cute little thing that could carry music. At Sony, when the Sony Walkman came out, there was talk. The first criteria for Sony was, let's build a box that people can carry music in and make it portable. That was the only objective. At Apple, the initial question was, how can we take over the music industry? How can we revolutionize the buying and selling of music? The iPod came much later on as a kind of detail for that larger systems redesign. So in the future, designers who want to sit at the table where decisions are being made, they're going to have to be able to talk about the ability to take over an entire industry, to change it economically first at its roots. Design comes much later somewhere along the line. And so, historically speaking, we're seeing that the art world moved well ahead of the design world in terms of embracing systems design. The designers are just arriving at it right now, but there is a fairly large gap that exists between the two disciplines. But I'll talk about that as we move forward. So Apple is interested in designing a system for reinventing the way in which music is bought and sold and delivering that experience through this little device called the iPod. And it happens to be, like the iPhone, a delivery system that continues to evolve in a myriad of different forms. This is one of the most recent, leading edge versions of this system. Increasingly, design projects have a greater sphere of influence. which is to say that they are progressively more interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary. In many quarters, the notion of design thinking has taken root, prosecuting the belief that designers should be educated as critical thinkers and strategists capable of addressing cross-disciplinary problems, designing social, political, economic, and educational systems, which in turn provide them with greater reach, responsibility, influence, and relevance. That's sort of the mantra at a number of schools that we partner with, the D School, IIT in Chicago, Design London. That kind of criteria, however, is rare, if at all ever found, in an art school, which would also suggest the two disciplines shifting apart, although we have to credit Burnham and others with being there first. Where are designers being educated to influence the creative economy? Nearly 50% of the design graduates at the Illinois Institute of Technology are consistently recruited by corporations not to design goods and services, but for their strategic design skills. When I was at Yale and Columbia, I was in the sculpture department, but GM, Microsoft, would come and try to recruit MFAs in sculpture, not because they wanted them to make sculpture, but because, as Bill Gates said, MFAs are creative problem solvers. They can anticipate problems and find quick solutions to them much faster than MBAs. And you might want to look at the article by Daniel Pink in the Harvard Business Review entitled The New MBA is the MFA. Per capita, corporations are hiring MFAs in greater numbers than MBAs going forward. This is also true, as I just mentioned, of Stanford's D School, the Stockholm School of Entrepreneurship. All these students are hired for their fundamentally different approach to defining problems and solutions using innovative methodologies and strategies across disciplines. Again, something that's rather rare in art schools. Alert to this, however, business schools, so Harvard Business School and INSEAD, are embedding these same design methodologies into their curriculum. Yet another example of interdisciplinarity. I've taught design thinking at both of these schools, not because we're trying to create designers out of MBAs, but we're trying to give them a methodology that they can apply to their own practice in business. These new designers I'm talking about have broad knowledge and empathy. They are able to work across disciplines, but are deep in at least one discipline. They are consummate design strategists, adept with practice-based research methodologies. And this would suggest that it will become less and less likely that we will begin to, or we will continue to see this ambiguous overlap between art and design. The disciplines are simply becoming too different. The currency for these new designers will be interdisciplinarity. It's what Ronald Burt, the sociologist from the University of Chicago, calls an economy of borrowed ideas. The usual image of creativity, Burt wrote, is that it's some sort of genetic gift, some heroic act, typical of many art schools. But Burt goes on, creativity is an import-export game. It's not a creation game. If you can get an idea which is mundane and well-known in one place to another place where people would get value out of it, he said, that is where it pays off today. That is where creativity sits today. Simply said, social interaction benefits the distribution of knowledge. People who live in the intersection of social worlds, Burt wrote, are at a higher risk of having good ideas. This is Burt's diagram. That's why he's not a designer. Why are they at higher risk of having good ideas? Because otherwise, if you're not at an intersection of multiple disciplines, your view of the world is something like this, partial. And here I mean partial, not just in the sense of seeing a part of the whole. I also mean partial as biased, as you see below, included to favor one party more than another. Notice, if you only have a partial view of the world, you're only seeing a partial view. But you're also partial. You're sort of inclined to support that particular worldview as opposed to taking in a number of worldviews all at the same time. So designers, artists, craftspersons working across disciplines, often furthest from their own, are best positioned to create new types of collaborations and alliances between the sciences and humanities by leveraging their knowledge and skills at sharing and synchronizing knowledge. This is probably the most important this is the most important thing that designers are learning today. There's great potential then for art and design to work together, but our future forecasts say that's probably not in the cards. Producing and managing new knowledge in the creative disciplines is trending, along with the creative economy, towards designing strategic alliances between universities, industries, non-for-profit organizations, policy groups, venture capitalists, and government bodies by creating new methodologies and heuristics for collaboration and implementation of ideas and knowledge transfer between disciplines. And once you hold up this paradigm shift against the backdrop of critical issues such as sustainability and social inequality, it seems to be that the most urgent question to ask right now is how to educate designers, artists, craftspeople to make the most optimal impact in bringing rapid change to increasingly complex problems. I think artists working with designers would be very good at that. How to do this? Most effective would be a shift in strategies, both in knowledge production and the way it is used in educating artists, designers, and craftspersons to perceive relevance and to convert it into new forms of knowledge while managing the high risk of failure that comes with interdisciplinary innovation. Now, as a metaphor for this shift in strategies, I want to tell you about a little bit of research work that we are currently doing in my group. It really surrounds, and it's applicable both to design and art, and if there were one issue that I would want to raise this morning in which artists and designers might have this ambiguous relationship, it has to do with creative problem solving. What actually happens when somebody has a eureka moment, you know, the part where they go, ah, right, I got it. It should be brown, not blue. Whatever it is. And so working with two cognitive neuroscientists and myself and another designer, we have begun to look at the way in which creative ideas actually form in the brain. We're actually looking at hunches. Just it's sort of intuitive knowledge that comes to people apparently out of nowhere. That's why divine intervention was accredited with this kind of indescribable knowledge for years and years. But for the last few years, Lee Miller at the University of California, Davis, Reed Cram, Peter Mannin, and I have been looking at the way in which, or trying to figure out what happens inside the brain when people have an insight. And the early research results we have from this offer us a persuasive allegory for the future of art and design's relationship moving forward. I don't have a whole lot of time to go into this, so we're going to cover it very briefly, although it's kind of interesting stuff. But in effect, what we do is we take subjects, about 50 at a time, and we give them 80 word games, and we give them 30 seconds each to answer those word games. And I'm going to give you one of them that we use now. You have 30 seconds to answer it, and if you have an answer, don't shout it out. Because we'll get to that in a second. But let me also warn you, since this is in English and it's a language shift, this is a word game that is not about associative relationships. Like if I say to you, Santa Claus, Tannenbaum, snow, you might say Christmas. This is not that kind of word game. You got to find one word that makes sense with the other three words. They're not associated at all. You're looking for one word that makes sense with the other three words. Everybody understand? More or less? Okay. If you don't, it really doesn't matter. Okay. So here we go. 30 seconds. There you go. And and I'll time it. You know, we do this test with just normal college students, so since this is, you know, a room full of designers and artists and philosophers, I expect, you know, that you could be much more creative than the run-of-the-mill. Okay. Now, don't shout it out, but did anybody get an answer? You think you have an answer? One? Okay, that's good. Okay. Well, let me tell you what happened in your brain for the last 30 seconds. This is what our research is all about. What actually happens in the brain when you're confronted with a problem that doesn't have an immediate answer, or we could just say it's unknown? How does creative problem solving actually work in the brain? Presented with a problem that the brain can't instantly recognize, the brain can't instantly find a solution for, the left side of the brain engages in a kind of linear thinking. A to B to C to D, looking for an answer. It lavishes all of its attention in the early goings. The brain lavishes all of its attention in the early goings on trying to find a solution. But it's only linear, in a linear kind of progression. And if the answer doesn't come, the brain changes strategies. So if an answer didn't come to you immediately, your brain changed strategies. It didn't ask you. It just does it automatically. And it shifts over to the right side, from the left hemisphere to the right hemisphere, where it's possible to begin to make very distant and unprecedented connections using a kind of all-at-once processing. So the left side, linear, one-to-one, shifts over to the right hemisphere, and it uses a kind of all-at-once processing in which it is capable of making distant and unprecedented connections. And here is a picture of what happens. I'm going to have to step down here. I hope you can hear me. This is actually what happened. This is a picture of someone given the workload that you were just given. And they got it. They got the right answer. And you can see what happens here when they begin, this insight line, when they begin to consider it on the left side, and things aren't going so well. And so it shifts about here to the right side, and then kaboom. Aha! I got it. I know what it is. And this happens in a very short period of time. This is actually the insight moment. And the yellow part are the appearance of gamma rays. And when people have creative ideas, we see an unprecedented spike of gamma rays. Whether you're, you know, if chocolate is your favorite, and you're eating chocolate cake, or you're having sex, or you're riding a bicycle because you love sports, your gamma rays don't match the spike as when we see somebody come up with a creative solution to a difficult problem. So that's interesting to know. Okay. Only one hand went up. And it's a friend of mine, but I did not tell him what the answer was. What's your answer?
I don't know if it's the answer, but I thought it was
red.
Red.
I explained why. No. It's wrong. We don't really care.
Barbecue?
Wrong too. We give the subjects 30 seconds, but in fact, if it doesn't come in one or two, it actually, the whole process is less than a second. The eureka moment, where you just go, ah, like that, it happens almost instantaneously. But we give them 30 seconds. So, I mean, it's a little demoralizing saying, if you don't get it in a second, we're going to move on. So we give them 30 seconds. And here's the answer. Okay? So pineapple, crab apple, and applesauce. We have linguists help us with the word puzzles because in this case, pineapple, apple goes behind, crab apple goes behind, but in the third one, apple goes in the front, and that's generally what screws people up. In 50 people, we generally only get three or four who get it right, so you shouldn't feel so bad. Now, what literally happens is that the cells distributed across the right hemisphere, exploiting their ability to make remote and unique connections, draw themselves together in a new network and produce the insight or the creative problem solving or the eureka moment. And I brought a little piece of a video that I'm going to show you, which is also of a subject looking at the pine sauce crab problem, and they are also a subject who got it. And so you can see what happens in somebody's brain when this creative moment comes. And that's really the substance of our research, is because we found that this process in the brain is very consistent across all scores of different kinds of subjects. And of course, we're doing more work with this, which if I have some time, but we're about to run out of time, I can tell you a little bit more about. But let me just tell you what you're going to see, and then I'll jump down and help narrate it. You're going to see the subject look at the puzzle, and their left side goes to work. And you're going to see it from the right side. So you're going to see a lot of yellow activity over here. And then if you watch a little closely, you're going to see a little blue cloud go over to the right. That's the brain shifting strategies. And then you're going to see this intense flash of yellow, and that's the aha moment, the eureka moment. And what you're seeing is somebody with a brain hat on, where we have sensors all over their brain, and then we put them inside of an MRI and make a movie so we can see this in three dimensions. So let me get it before you cycle on time. Okay, so here's the puzzle. I'm not getting it. And here comes the blue thing. And it comes, boom. So this part there, boom. That's the aha moment. This film, we slowed way down. It's less than a second long. It took them less than a second to get Apple. And so we slowed it down in order to look at it. But, so this is then the mapping of a brain when it has this creative moment, when it is at its most creative. And so for all the artists and designers in the audience, this is what you want to go back to your studio to do, I guess. But we took something else from this research, and it goes like this. That this shifting strategies from left hemisphere to right, from linear thinking to making unprecedented connections across routine boundaries, what you're seeing right here is the neuroscientists and Reed and I feel as though what we're watching is the shifting from monodisciplinary thinking to interdisciplinary thinking, from linear thinking to an all-at-once kind of a cross-disciplines kind of thinking. And it's a metaphor for problem-solving that is less precise but better connected. And that, in effect, is what interdisciplinarity is. It's less precise, but it's better connected. And we've now taken this, not only in the experience design group, but the neuroscientists have also taken it to the medical school, and we've developed a teaching method around it called ganging intellects. Which is the sharing and synchronizing of knowledge across disciplines. Well, of course, everybody, sometimes when you get involved in future forecasting, you're way out there. We always like to look backwards first. In fact, we think that the future is going to look a little bit the way that the economist Friedrich Hayek, who is a Nobel laureate, described a free market in his 1945 manifesto, The Use of Knowledge in Society. There he expressed his belief that the sharing and synchronization of knowledge takes place as diverse individuals cooperate for their own assorted goals, and as a result, serendipitously create universal benefit. Any person's knowledge is by definition partial, Hayek reasoned, and therefore truth, in his words, can only be established when people pool their knowledge. And so Hayek himself in 1945 predicted this fundamental shift in art and design that we're witnessing now. As a theory of collaboration in knowledge production and distribution between art and design, Hayek's theory provides a taproot for some of the most provocative ideas about interdisciplinarity. And just as Bert suggested, we can carry over his socioeconomic theory and apply it to our own art or design practices. And so, in summary, these are the issues, interdisciplinary got cut off, that these are the key issues involved in this transition, interdisciplinarity, creating new knowledge, research, distributing the knowledge, and sharing and synchronizing information. And so what I wanted to say is, as interesting as this ambiguous relationship between art and design is, while I see these subjects being taught with great clarity in design schools, as I move around the world, I don't see them being taught with great clarity in art schools. So perhaps you recognize that this presentation itself has been designed as a simulation of creating hybrid knowledge, and that's probably the most valuable thing at hand. Hybrid knowledge by ganging together, and these are the subjects we talked about this morning: economics, literature, art, sociology, design, cognitive neuroscience, craft, and politics, with the end purpose of perceiving relevance often furthest from our own disciplines and converting it into new forms of knowledge. And I just recall, as a way to conclude, that we've heard this before. Our Buckminster Fuller described it as a synthesis when he wrote, "A designer is an emerging synthesis of artist, inventor, mechanic, objective economist, and evolutionary strategist." And it's a risk, but it's a risk with abundant opportunities, and also abundant opportunities for failure, but of course, innovation always is. Thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I wouldn't say it's marketing. I would say it's evangelical. I'm quite committed to this way of approach. And you're right. Creativity as a concept is, people still associate it with divine inspiration. And that's part of the reason we're doing the research we're doing, is to quantify it as best we can. There are many unanswered questions out there. We're just beginning this. But at least the cognitive neuroscientists were surprised to see that human brains react in this situation consistently, at least from the data that we've seen so far. And then the question is, how can we use that and make it relevant, not only to designers, but also to design education or art education. But the business about talking about the experience economy is a part of the creation of our research group, is the recognition that we've moved from goods and services to an experience economy. And if design and art, for that matter, want to continue to have any relevance, there's going to have to be a recognition and an embrace that your audience is not living in that kind of economy. And also we're seeing social and political changes at the same time. I can give you the same talk, except we'll only talk about politics, or I can give you the same talk, we'll just talk about sociology. In this case, we emphasized the economy. So in my experience, anyway, of moving around the world, in most art and design schools, people are pretty surprised to learn that we're living in an experience economy. And in that sense, it's kind of hard to be relevant. It's a sort of H.G. Wells point that the university had, its time passed, and we needed to look at a new and more relevant way for collecting and distributing knowledge. And what I'm saying is that the way in which we see design functioning in the world today, we should probably recognize the environment that it's having to live in order to assure ourselves of our relevance.
Are we then talking about experience societies only in the West, but for example, if you live in Africa, third world countries, this is not possible. I mean, you need to have time and you need to have money to live in an experience economy. So, what is then with this your expression of design, which is only related to this experience?
Yep. That's a good question too, and it would look that way when you first started out with this. But it is certainly seated within a highly industrialized Western civilization. But in fact, the kinds of research questions that we address ourselves to in experience design are applicable in many different kinds of situations. And I can mention one that will just take 2 sentences. One of the first projects that we did, and we're still involved with that right now, was based around one single research question, which is, can experience design have an impact on patient recovery time in hospitals? Yes, it can. And what we've learned through that, we're not talking about pretty paintings and, you know, Muzak and that kind of stuff. We're talking about the experience patients have over time. What happens to them? We can apply what we've learned there to UN refugee camps in Africa, and we can apply it to the most sophisticated Western hospitals in Stockholm. So some of the, as I say, certainly it's seated in a very advanced industrialized economy, but the kinds of research we're doing have greater reach and relevance outside of itself. It's such a new discipline that those questions that you ask are good, and we ask ourselves those questions. I might also just mention one other project we're working on. At the hospital in Stockholm, the nursing staff recognize that humans, by and large, go through, this is not just involved in Stockholm, but at least their research shows internationally, humans go through the same experiences the last 5 to 7 days of their life. And so they recognize the need for experience designers. They've called us in, and we're looking at, we just started this, but looking at how to enhance those or recognize those so that nursing staff or communities, if there is no hospital, can make a person more comfortable the last few days of their life. So those would be 2 examples. I mean, we're also, you know, working with Vodafone, so yeah, we're doing that too. But we're also doing this other kind of work. Yes, ma'am. What do I think art could do for design? Yeah. Let me go backwards. We didn't examine artists, it was just a cattle call. University students weren't wanted to earn $50. And we didn't, they had to be a university student. That was the only criteria, but we didn't ask. I mean, this research had just started. But certainly, we might want to look at the difference between an engineer and an artist, or a poet and a brain surgeon, going forward. And no, it only happens on the eureka moment. Only happens on the right side, for the work that we've done so far. We've looked at what we did was we gathered together I think 15 or 20 people who are really good at this, and then we began to put them through more complex puzzles, and they are all doing pretty well. And it always happens on the right side of the brain. I might just also say that the U.S. Army is very interested in this right now, because they found just in day-to-day experience, and then I'll get back to the art and design question, that there are certain guys or women who are doing patrols who turn a corner and look down a street and just say, no, we're not going to go down there, and then a bomb goes off. And then when you say to them, how do you know that? They say, I don't know. I don't know how I sense that. But typically, for Sweden has given us a grant to study this for firemen. Firemen in a burning house looking for a way out. If we have a guy in there who is very good at hunch making, and we can put sensors in his helmet to detect his hunches and communicate them to the rest of the firefighters, we're kind of going in that direction. So it's applicable. You know, it's not just pretty pictures, I guess we'd say. What could art do with design? I'm wondering that myself, because from what we see and what we're projecting, say 5-7 years out, the kind of education artists are by and large receiving, from my experience, principally in the United States and in Europe, is not compatible with the kind of education designers are perceiving. And so we may be seeing less of a relationship or this ambiguous relationship moving forward. We'll have to see. I don't know if that's a good or bad thing. Yes, sir. Well, let me just say.
Could design not be about creating problems instead of just solving them? And art is about creating problems. I understand that you cannot fit in art in your definition of design because your definition doesn't allow it. You're still thinking about problem solving.
Well, actually,
where is the God that defined that design should be problem solving?
Yep. I guess I should have said this somewhere wrong. In fact, we make a strong point of saying that the kind of design we're teaching is not problem solving, it's entrepreneurial. But the problem solving is taking the client's expectations and working inside of that box. And we're talking about being entrepreneurial. We're talking about, and not in terms of making money, we're talking about entrepreneurial as a methodology for doing research, of deciding that you have an idea that can have a great impact on the world and carrying that forward, not just solving problems, but actually contributing to the world in a larger sense. And I would also think that Hans Hacke's example of this is an entrepreneurial work of art, where he went out and showed that, in fact, the Rhine could be pollution-free if we just wanted to do that. Hacke's work is a great example of a kind of entrepreneurial, not problem-solving, but entrepreneurial approach, and that's what we're teaching our designers to do. You're exactly right. Jen and I were talking about this before. She said she gets her best ideas washing dishes. And when we interview mathematicians or physicists or different kinds of folks in the university, they all say, it came to me in the shower. Or the mathematician that we looked at very closely who solved this very complex problem, he said, I got it stepping onto a bus. And so the cognitive neuroscientists are in charge of the setting the conditions. And as I say, we're just starting on this. But they're as neutral as we can find. It's quite another thing to wire somebody's brain up and put him in an MRI machine. But we're only doing that with people who already are really good at this, or we've already identified them, just naturally being, or apparently naturally being good at this. So it is just a quiet, kind of neutral space that they're happening in. But we're very aware of that, and I can only say that I've always used the prototype face for no particular good reason. Okay, this one.
Because of the list, it's either human and the objective economist or Wait, give it to me again. It's echoing or something. I can't hear.
The power monger. Yeah. The person who can handle power.
Yeah.
That's also, I think, a really good question. In other words, how do you handle power in these situations? And we actually give a seminar on that to our designers. The seminar is titled after Joseph Nye's book, who's the dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. It's titled Soft Power. In other words, how do you convince people that your ideas are worth adopting rather than hard power, where you force them to adopt those ideas? And that course is taught by a sociologist. And in that sense, it's not marketing. It's not about razzle-dazzle. It's actually even more sinister. It's about how do you convince a group of people that your ideas are valuable and worth adopting. One of the three areas that we divide our research into is called persuasive experiences. How can art and design change people's minds, persuade them to change their goals or values or core values? And that also has a real dark side, but it also can have a very positive side moving forward. Okay? Are we done here?
Go ahead. I'm back to this picture. This kind of point in your evolution, buying things for the cake everywhere, putting it together, has certain relevance for the future. Because I see in this, this point somehow the interdisciplinarity unified in one person. And what my experience of the interdisciplinarity is always a lot of talking, no results.
Yeah, you're right.
But, I'm looking back, I know persons like Le Corbusier, Charles Eames, other folks. These are still kind of these points. Do you think this has still relevance for the future?
Well, let me say two things. I just touched on it briefly, that we're only first beginning to see the results back from looking at how effective interdisciplinarity is, and in fact, it fails most of the time. And so there's a lot of talking and no results. Yes, sir, that's exactly what generally happens. Part of that is that I think we lack the methodologies to do that, and numbers of groups are developing those methodologies right now. But let me also say that Lee Fleming's research on interdisciplinarity, looking at patents, whether they're design patents or medical patents, or he looked at 17,000 patents. The good news on the interdisciplinarity side is the only time breakthrough innovations occur is in interdisciplinary teams. You get a lot more innovations in monodisciplinary projects, but the only time you really see breakthrough innovations are in interdisciplinary teams. I think that's why Columbia has shifted its whole science program over in that direction. And I think to answer the question, it's a generational problem. My generation won't get there, but the kids that are moving through our program right now, they're like ducks to water on this stuff. They're very, very good at it. And Charles Eames, all of those folks, we, as best we can, look at to see how they succeeded going forward, and grabbing what we can from there. But I also have to say that where you're talking about visionaries, it was or Bucky Fuller is another good example. Their context was so different from ours; it's hard to make the translation.